The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
All right, so tonight, I just want to share with you my own explorations of dukkha. You know, I like to take these opportunities, you know, when I give a talk to really, you know, what did the Buddha have to say about dukkha and what is my experience with dukkha? So dukkha, one Pali translation is that it's incapable of satisfying. So unsatisfactory, incapable of satisfying. And as we all know, it's the first of the Four Noble Truths. and the Four Noble Truths are, of course, the central teaching of the Buddha. And there's a quote that he has about, the footprint of the elephant is the largest of all footprints, and the footprints of all legged creatures can fit inside the footprint of the elephant, and the footprint of the elephant is the Four Noble Truths. All skillful means can exist inside the Four Noble Truths. So there is suffering, and there is a cause of suffering. There's an end of suffering, and there's a path out of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So the way to practice the Four Noble Truths is to get really interested in our suffering. I always like Thich Nhat Hanh's image of holding our suffering like a little sister or a little brother. We hold it close. We take care of it. So it's an interesting question. What is the ordinary and inevitable pain of being human? And what is the suffering that we create? And this is a kind of life koan, isn't it? And Buddha, you know, adopted a medical model. He said, you know, with this Four Noble Truths, it's like recognizing the problem. What is the problem? What is the prescription? So the problem is suffering. What is the cause of the suffering? And then what is the prescription? What is the solution? So the Four Noble Truths is a lifelong investigation. But also they can bloom all together in any moment of experience. So I think it needs to be held in that way. So I thought it would be worthwhile bringing up the etymology of the word dukkha, which is closely connected to the word sukha. Dukkha, in a sense, meaning bad, sukha, meaning bliss or happiness. The kha of both of those words means the hub of a wheel, the hub of a wheel. And the sukha is like it's good. The dukkha is it's bad, it's misaligned. So one definition of dukkha is a wheel out of true. It's in misalignment. And I think it's useful to think it's the understanding that isn't in alignment. And because the understanding isn't in alignment with the truth of how things are, we have a bumpy road on this misaligned wheel. And two, just to carry the metaphor one step further, what propels this wheel are the forces of hatred, the forces of ignorance, and the forces of greed. And they're depicted as three animals chasing each other's tail, kind of setting this wheel in motion. So there is this truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, of stress. And it needs to be understood. So the first step, and I'm drawing now a lot from a wonderful elaboration on the Four Noble Truths by Ajahn Sumedho, So I really recommend this famous kind of discourse on the Four Noble Truths that he offers. So the first step is admitting suffering into our consciousness. And I think, you know, in a funny way, we can be reluctant to do that because it can feel like suffering is a personal failure, you know. And I think even in Buddhist communities, maybe particularly in Buddhist communities, there can be a kind of shadow around that. Like, if we're suffering, you know, how are you identified? Or, you know, like, whatever that thing might be, that sort of subtle shadow. So we need to admit it into our consciousness. Suffering is a condition of our birth, and what comes together separates, right? And we need to expect this. So the Buddha's words, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, disassociation from the loved is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. Yeah, and to just keep this front and center, I think is not at all depressing. I feel it's quite liberating. It's quite enlivening to recognize the fragility, the impermanence of our lives. And that can be the cause for us to live with more compassion and less delusion. And I really appreciate these remembrances that we've been chanting, which the Buddha said is the cause for the Eightfold Path to take birth. Are these remembrances, I'm the nature to die. I have not gone beyond aging. I'm sorry, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So in a way that it comes out of need, I keep myself really close to death and dying and suffering and sickness as much as I can. You know, it's like, I think in our culture there's a way of hiding these things that are distressing, and we're living in a way that is intended to kind of protect us from the truth of these things. And I think it you know, we kind of live in a spell that way. When my father died, with Mark's parents, when they died, with friends, when they died, you know, it feels really impactful to take that time to let the heart be broken, to open compassionately, and to learn, and to kind of really learn the impersonal nature of this process, and to not, it's not feeling sorry for that person. This is my story too. You know, it's not a separating. This is my story too. So awaking me from the spell that I am somehow exempt. You know, we have this cat bear that appeared at the Prairie Farm Retreat property. You know, he showed up on the compost heap and was filled with ticks and was skinny and scrappy. And after a lot of discussion, we decided to take him home. And he's been kind of part of our household. And at first, he was a terror in our neighborhoods and in our house and all these things. And but, you know, I've come to really adore this scrappy cat. I love him to death. And I, you know, he's an outside cat. He was came from the outside. He's an outside cat, and he wanders long and far, and I don't know where he goes. He crosses many streets. I heard he went into the birchwood once. He is a wandering cat, and every time I let him out, I feel it. You know, I feel the fragility. May you come back. I want you to come back, Bear. I know you might not, but I want you to, you know, and just sort of like just being sensitive to that feeling in the heart, to any clinging that can be let go of. But just like each time I let him out, I take it as a little lesson, you know. He might not come back, or I might not be back if he comes, you know, when he comes back, you know. I'm fragile too. This is Ajahn Chah from the Thai forest tradition. He says, in Dhamma practice, we begin with the truth of dukkha, the pervasive unsatisfactoriness of existence. But as soon as we experience this, we lose heart. We don't want to look at it. It's similar to the way we don't like to look at old people, but prefer to look at the young and attractive. Without seeing dukkha, we don't really look into and resolve our problems. We just bear with them or pass them by indifferently. So the first step is to admit dukkha into the consciousness, and then the second step is to understand it. Dukkha is to be understood versus gotten rid of. And, you know, it's our habit, of course, as sensitive beings, to run from the pain of dukkha. You know, we run because it's unpleasant. And we run because we assume there's nothing to be understood. I know this. I know this dukkha. You know, I just want to be away from it. So it's a real shift in, a radical shift that is not supported, certainly, by our culture. The shift to appreciate that there is something to be understood. There's a reason to be intimate with dukkha. In Pali, you know, this you know, dukkha must be understood. Understood also has, understanding also means standing under, kind of. So there's this flip of, standing under, in the sense of like fully embracing, fully welcoming, standing under dukkha. I have this image of like a redwood forest or a sky, you know, and just this pervasive, you know, fact, standing under dukkha, and how silly to quibble with dukkha, you know. It kind of, it just highlights that, how silly to quibble, you know. So non-resistance, that's an interesting word, non-resistance. How to embrace. So the Buddha described three different kinds of unsatisfactoriness, and they all are born out of tanha, born out of thirst or craving. And they're all interrelated. So if there's first we'll call it the suffering of suffering, dukkha, which is, you know, as I was talking about before, just part of our contract of being born in this human body with sensitivity and all the pain of mental pain, of physical pain, sickness, separation from things that we love and care about, this very ordinary, understandable dukkha. And a lot of what we're working with here today, and I've been, you know, personally really powerfully impacted by, learning in certain situations to embrace dukkha, to learn from dukkha. You know, it's interesting. I'm a teacher, and I come from, you know, being a performer, a dancer, and a choreographer. in ways that, you know, this profession in which I'm kind of, it's very public and very exposed. And I'm very reserved. I mean, it's very, it's still difficult for me. You know, I've been teaching at McAllister College for 10 years. And still, it's like standing in front of a room and having to control the room and being, you know, just being alive to all the things that happen when you're in front of a room and you're the one in charge. Like, there's a level of difficulty with that for me still. And it was the most poignant for me as I was, you know, starting to learn to perform as a dancer, like these just fears of being exposed in this very primitive way, you know. It really taught me how to work with fear and how to work with self-doubt. I had to, you know, because it was so front and center in my experience. And this is ongoing. You know, like even last night, I was just sitting here, just so enjoying Mark's Dhamma talk. There's just this opening, just drinking in the Dhamma, really beautiful appreciation. And then I just very clearly saw it, the thought emerged, I have to give a talk tomorrow night. And it was like, and then all of a sudden, you know, there was, oh, this just self-doubt, and oh, this was so good, and oh, well, you know, just this whole dance of fear, a little anxiety, you know, but it's not new, you know, it's like, that's the beauty for me, it's like, you know, I recognize these patterns, this sort of ancient stuff, who knows why, you know, it's like, I don't even ask that question, who knows why, I see it come up, and so it's like my go-to place. I'm, you know, in the walking meditation afterward, it's like, oh, you know, anxiety, oh, self-doubt. It's like, just pour it on, you know. It's like, open the space. Just let these energies of self-doubt do their dance. And I let them. I really let them, you know. And it's like getting as big as I need to be. Sorry, this makes me teary, to really, and so, you know, and what's the protection? You know, how is it that we're able to allow the space of non-resistance, you know, where suddenly there's so much space, there's no more friction in it, you know, there's safety. So it's an interesting question, and like, just this idea of abiding in the mind that knows the experience, the mind that's aware, and that's not tangled with the experience. So we have this available to us to be in that mind that's clear and undisturbed. And I love the image of, you know, of if we were to imagine that kind of mind, the metaphor of space, and we throw a brush of paint into the space, it doesn't land, right? Like the space, it goes elsewhere. The space itself is undisturbed. And I think it's just a beautiful, if we haven't seen that, to look for that in the experience, the part of the mind that's stable and can witness all the tangle. And it's not like we see it once, right? Like, so I had this walking meditation, very spacious, but that was my first thought when I woke up this morning. I have to give a talk, right? You know, there it is again. It's like, okay, boom, boom, you know. And sometimes I do resist. Sometimes, you know, it's like I don't have the wherewithal to kind of meet it, you know. And so it's just then we practice patience and we can have compassion. And this opening is a movement of the heart. It's a movement of compassion as opposed to a movement of hatred. Because we can hate these things about ourselves. We can hate our fear. We can hate our self-doubt, you know. And it's really important to see if that's happening. And I just want to make one other point. Like, this idea of whether I give a talk competently or not competently is an entirely different issue. You know what I mean? This is an otherworldly aspiration around freedom, you know, no matter what the conditions. So I just want to say that it's a separate agenda. Yeah. So letting in these afflictive mind states, and I really like that little quote Mark gave to me this morning from Utejaniya, that we don't need to be afraid, right? We don't need to be afraid of our hatred, for instance. Like, that's really important. You know, we need to investigate it. And as long as we're afraid of all our pettiness, all our meanness, all the ways that we judge, right, we'll never shine the light on it. It's like, that's not me. That's not happening. So I think we need to kind of understand that admitting all parts of ourselves, everything is included. Everything is included in our awareness. This is a poem by Rumi. It's called The Guest House. He says, "This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." So I also want to just like recognizing this example that I was giving around abiding in the knowing mind, you know, that there is a shift of self, you know, from a defended, narrow self to a different understanding or feeling or perception of self. And this also can be an object of investigation, looking closely at the sense of self, at its, how it's really fluid, how it comes and goes, how it gets really solid, how it gets permeable, sometimes how it disappears. You know, like, this can be an object in our attention. And I really appreciate Thich Nhat Hanh's words and metaphor around, you know, the sense of a personal self. It's like a wave cresting on the sea, right? It has a life. But it's from the water, right? It's from this, it's this place that we share. And he just says this beautifully. He says, "When we look at the ocean, we see that each wave has a beginning and an end. A wave can be compared with other waves, and we can call it more or less beautiful, higher or lower, longer lasting or less long lasting. But if we look more deeply, we see that a wave is made of water. While living the life of a wave, the wave also lives the life of water. It would be sad if the waves did not know that it is water. It would think, someday I will have to die. This period of time is my lifespan. And when I arrive at the shore, I will return to non-being. These notions will cause the wave fear and anguish. A wave can be recognized by signs, beginning or ending, high or low, beautiful or ugly. In the world of the wave, the world of relative truth, the wave feels happy as she swells, and she feels sad as she falls. She may think, I am high or I am low, and develop superiority or inferiority complexes. But in the world of the water, there are no signs. And when the wave touches her true nature, which is water, all of her complexes will cease, and she will transcend birth and death." That's from Thich Nhat Hanh's The Heart of the Buddhist Teaching. And just one more quote from Krishnamurti. He says, "It's the truth which liberates, not your efforts to be free." I think that's really interesting. Like, so our efforts need to be in seeing the truth, not in wishing to be free, you know, aligning with the truth, insight. this is not me, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, the Buddha. So all that, the first kind of suffering, dukkha. And then the second suffering, kind of suffering, is described as the suffering of impermanence. And this just points to the very accessible and ordinary fact that things that we want to hold, that are pleasurable, that are meaningful to us, will go away, you know, and they're suffering because it's unstable. And we, things that we don't like, things that cause us discomfort, will eventually, we will have to come in contact with, we will experience. So it's this fragility of pleasure and unpleasure, this impermanence of objects coming and going, pleasing, unpleasing. And, you know, and this is a little bit of an aside, but, you know, to recognize how kind of our honing device toward pleasure is such a powerful force, you know, in a motivating behavior. And there's that metaphor of the bull with the ring in its nose that can be handled by an 80-pound boy, right? Because he can, if the bull wanders away from where the boy intends, he can tug on the nose, and that pain keeps the bull in line. So a 1,000-pound bull will move through life like this, just to avoid the tug of pain. And so I think it's kind of humbling, but I think it's useful to hold that image of ourselves, like, you know, I'm waiting for that moment till I can have the brownie, you know, and then I eat it and then it's gone. And it's just like these things that can be really apparent or they can be really invisible, you know, and we can bring our attention to that. So the suffering of impermanence and this pervasive suffering is the third category, which is sort of a more subtle form of suffering, which is a kind of background of discontent, a background of anxiety, of insecurity. And this is based on just the nature of all conditioned phenomenon is unreliable. So this pervasive, quieter suffering, chronic suffering. I've been noticing a little bit of that for me just around kind of the aging body, you know, kind of coming from a dance background and just like, you know, and it's not a big suffering, it's like a little background suffering, like just feeling my body change. And I find it really interesting, like I'm noticing this in my own mind and I see it in our culture too, that there can be a kind of shame around aging, like, and shame around getting sick. Like, you know, like we somehow own, like we are somehow personally responsible for the agingness of this body or that this body has gotten sick. So that's just interesting to kind of shine the light on this quality of shame. And also that this body, you know, is ours and it's under our control. You know, there's that feeling, it's under our control. And I've been doing a lot of studying of anatomy, you know, with the Buddhist teaching, there's this kind of reflections on the 32 body parts, you know, as a reflection, as a contemplation, but also like looking at anatomy, like really getting to know the body on this very anatomical level. And my friend, actually, she's here, she showed me once this video, it's called The Inner Life of the Cell, right? It's this animated video. And it's like incredible. It's like the complexity within the cell, it was like Manhattan, you know, just the amount of things happening. And then, but you know, when you look even more deeply, no, it's like a solar system, you know, incredible. And the kind of intelligence and operating things that we are, you know, we are clueless, yet, you know, I am I'm the dictator here of this form, or whatever that is. which we can really undermine through this reflection, through this deliberate contemplation and looking inward. So, you know, with this hub, this misaligned wheel, one of the misalignments is not realizing the truth of impermanence. And one of the misalignments is not realizing the nature of self or not self. I found just another interesting thing I hadn't read before, just words of the Buddha, you know, about just this, you know, impersonal nature of our human cycles, of our lives. And it's the earlier reflections, but just slightly reworded. He said, "I am not the only one for whom what is subject to old age grows old. I am not the only one for whom what is subject to illness grows ill. I am not the only one for whom what is subject to death dies. I am not the only one for whom what is subject to destruction is destroyed. I am not the only one for whom what is subject to loss is lost." And I think, you know, when we face our illnesses, when we face our aging body, you know, we can hold that close. You know, this is not a personal story. In terms of this sort of backdrop, this background, pervasive, quieter, subtle suffering, I just wanted to offer an example of that too, this sort of subtle clinging to self. I was in a yoga class last week, and yeah, it's funny how my yoga kind of has really deepened over the years, and just, you know, letting go of a lot of agendas, like I'm just here, I'm just with my body. There's a lot of interest in just being with the body. And so there's, you know, a lot of sustained attention and interest. And just the other week, you know, I was like really in my body. And then I just noticed the mind, you know, just this little, it was like so soft. It was like this misty rain. You could barely see it. But it was just kind of commenting, like, "You do that triangle pose well," or "Feel how free, you know, your legs are when you do that. And look at the woman in front of you who just doesn't quite know where her pelvis is." And look, you know, and this is all fine. It's not an issue, right? It's just kind of what the mind does. But I also saw in that quality, there was a quality of slight, like, clinging, like a quality of, like, just something that was like a little suffering, just this, you know. And it just interested me. And so I just kind of turned my attention, like, just to this gentle narration going on in the background. And, you know, and I saw, oh yeah, this is just this way of separating. This is this way of separating myself in this moment, this way of creating myself in this moment. I'm different from her, you know, because my body's here and her body's there. And just this subtle kind of little judgment. And it was just beautiful. And in the moment of, like, "I see you," you know, and there was a dropping away. You know, it was just a beautiful moment of release. And I could just feel this liberating quality of having seen this part of the mind, you know, at least in those moments, sort of a free fall, a different experience, just to turn my attention, just to notice this was happening. And Tanisaro Biko, I really love his, you know, he talks about all the different parts of our attention, and he says skillful and less skillful members of the committee, you know, like different parts of the mind. And so it was like, oh, in that moment, there was a skillful member of the committee that was interested in seeing, that was interested in wisdom, and turned the attention. Because sometimes there's a member of the committee that wants to feel a little puffed up. "I'm a good yogi, you know, I'm going to feed that," right? So it's like seeing the multiplicity of committee members that live inside us. So in terms of this quality of impermanence and its unsatisfactoriness, this is Ajahn Chah. He says, "You see this goblet," asks Ajahn Chah. "For me, this glass is already broken. I enjoy it. I drink out of it. It holds my water admirably. Sometimes even reflecting the sun is beautiful, in beautiful patterns. If I should tap it, it has a lovely ring to it. But when I put this glass on the shelf and the wind knocks it over, or my elbow brushes it off the table and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, 'Of course.' When I understand that the glass is already broken, every moment is precious." So I think it's an interesting metaphor, like this feeling of being already broken, not in a bad sense, but just we're in motion. You know, we're in motion. We're not held together in the way that we think that we are. And I just wanted to offer, before we end this, a friend and longtime member of the Common Ground community, Sue Cochran. You know, she's had this long journey with cancer, which, you know, she has a terminal diagnosis, and she has a blog where she kind of just shares her thoughts and ideas, and and so I was so moved by something that she said in her blog. I wanted to share it with you, and it's called Kintsugi, the Golden Joinery of Love, an Ancient Japanese Art Shows How to Heal a Broken Life. And these are her words on the blog. So, "I was surprised and honored to be invited as a keynote speaker last month in Atlanta for an innovative national healthcare organization. A few years ago, my brother introduced me to his friend, the CEO of this company, via email. He is a remarkable leader and writer who follows my cancer journey with kindness and support. We agreed I would focus part of the talk on the terminal cancer diagnosis and how I stay positive, even joyful, despite this challenge. I knew the team was young, and I wanted, at the very least, to be interesting and, if possible, inspirational. I knew it was not going to be easy to simmer my life's journey and message into 1 hour. I had also just learned the cancer had advanced beyond my brain and bones into the liver and lungs. I sincerely was walking the walk and not just talking the talk, as they say in AA." And then she talks about, you know, just trying to find, you know, just the right theme. What was she going to offer? And then she says, "It was then, surrounded by my beloved books, quotes, and poems, that I received the answer on how to put the pieces of the talk together. Something a friend told me in passing months earlier came to mind. She had mentioned an ancient Japanese method of repairing broken porcelain that uses gold to fill the cracks. I remember loving that idea immediately, more than Leonard Cohen's famous lyric, 'There is a crack in everything, and that is where the light comes in.' For some reason, when I pictured being cracked up inside, I tended to feel a harsh wind coming in, and not the light. This method of restoring breakage with gold is called Kintsugi and translates as golden joinery. I did some quick research and discovered that Kintsugi is an outgrowth of the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi, which honors the beauty of imperfections. The Kintsugi artisan uses gold or other precious metals mixed with epoxy to repair the broken piece. This method emphasizes, rather than hides, the breakage. The repaired piece is often considered even more beautiful than the original. Kintsugi embraces the breakage as part of the object's history. Instead of something unacceptable to be hidden or thrown away, this is the opposite of what I was taught. I learned that I was supposed to be perfect and that I must hide any imperfections. This belief is embedded in our culture. If something is broken, toss it out. If something is flawed, hide it. Kintsugi was the perfect metaphor for my talk on how I was able to find healing in a life that for a long time was not only cracked, but broken apart, and in a few places shattered beyond recognition. I no longer think of my broken parts as wounds. They are part of my history and who I have become. As an ancient Kintsugi quote says, the true life of the bowl began the moment it was dropped. So I think we'll have a little bit of time for questions, but I wanted to do just a short few minute reflection together, like just a few minutes where I just would like us all just to choose to locate a stressor in our life right now. Like, what is one stressor in our life that we want to reflect on? You know, maybe it's a chronic dukkha, maybe it's a loss. Maybe something dear to you, like your youth, is going away. And just with a real open mind and open heart, you know, how do I relate to this stressor? And we can explore an intention, kind of calling on our wisdom, calling on our resources, calling on our creativity, finding ways that maybe we can use this particular stressor, this particular circumstance, to serve an awakening in my heart and mind. Okay, opening the eyes, coming back. Huh? All right. So, Q&A, is that okay? Or just, okay. Yeah, so we have about 10 minutes, and, you know, maybe we can just think of this as like a sharing time, or if, you know, this brought up any questions for you that you'd like to address.
I just had some questions about that. You talked about like the place that's unmoved by circumstance. I don't remember the exact words you used, but and maybe this is getting impractically philosophical or in the weeds, but like, is that the observer, or is it an object that can be observed? And is the goal to become identified with that?
Yeah, I realize it's sort of, you know, the way I worded that was, I think maybe the way I worded that was to abide in the space of knowing, like when is now in the space of knowing, which is a little bit not correct, you know, in that way. So I think it's, I think it's okay actually to identify with that. And it's not the final step, but I think it's okay. And that can be explored too. You know, how is Andrew the space of knowing? You know, it's interesting that this perception of self can be looked at in each of the aggregates, each of the five aggregates, these heaps, collections, like, is the self in the body? You know, is the self in my perceptions? Is the self in my mental activity? And is the self in consciousness? You know?
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.